This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of all people are needed to make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak on bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 9 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can log into our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com, to join us live, listen to archives of previous shows, or join us in our live chat room on PalTalk. You can listen by phone, dial 805-399-1000, enter access code 769-608-pound when prompted, or on your computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to Station 2, and click the listen icon. If you have questions and comments for our guest or topic during the show, please call toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Tonight, my guest is retired Ambassador Edward Peck, who, as I was commenting to him earlier, spent almost his entire career in the Foreign Service in a part of the region that, since I spoke to him last in July of 2010, has changed greatly. And I've so looked forward to the opportunity to get his opinion on those changes. Good evening, Ambassador. Hello?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you for a minute there.
I'm sorry. My fault.
Go ahead. Good evening.
Good evening to you.
Now, during your Foreign Service career, which spanned from 56 to 89, I'm going to run for the audience. You served in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. You were ambassador to Mauritania, chief of mission in Baghdad in 77 to 80. And under President Reagan, you were on the White House Task Force on Terrorism, which to me seems you have a pretty long perspective on events in that region tonight. Would you like to give us from your experience, what is happening there now?
Well, I think, you know, people can argue about what causes this and what causes that. And an awful lot of the people who will comment on it don't really have necessarily a great deal of experience living in that part of the world. And no fault of their own necessarily, but it does make a difference when you cannot, you know, quote from experience on one of the things, what are the things that are happening and why. The seeds were planted a long time ago. That part of the world which anchors Asia, Africa, and Europe, it's the crossroads for all three. It's home of the world's three greatest religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which have their own problems internally. And for many, many years, over the centuries, the area was overrun, I think it was a total of 16 different times, by people who came in from outside and changed everything, and then eventually disappeared for one reason or another. So then you had the period of colonialism, in which European nations came in and pretty much ran things the way they wanted them for a while, and then they left. And what you have now is the residual remnants of all of those things happening, and all of a sudden, because of the circumstances in that part of the world, coming unglued, unfortunately, and rather rapidly, and without many signs of solution or resolution in the near term, I'm afraid. That's a long answer to a short question. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to throw you into a longer one. Ambassador Peck, a lot of speculation I've heard among the common man, and this reflects the level of distrust we have for our government at this point, is the speculation that the uprising in Egypt, the uprising in Tunisia, were in fact behind the scenes plotting by the USA, similar to the CIA and the British interfering in Iran during the mid-50s. Would you, from your perspective, would you say there's any validity to that?
No, I don't think so. First, because it was so grossly not in our interests to do that, but also because I think it would be very difficult to foment the sorts of things that have been happening in those countries from outside.
Now, my impression, too, because I've also paid attention to that, not to the degree you have, was that our government was rather, in fact, caught flat-footed, that they're rather scrambling to deal with unexpected events rather than being the initiator of those events. Would I be far off?
No, and even if they had been the initiators, you know, the first thing that you learn in that kind of activity is that, well, you may quote me, this is one of my most powerful aphorisms, the most difficult thing to predict is the future. So that, you know, once you start something like that rolling, you have no possible idea where it's going to go, when, how quickly, and with what results. So to have done that would have been exceptionally difficult and stupid, as it turns out. But I don't think we did it. And I know that people will think that we did, because that's been the nature of our involvement with that part of the world for a long, long time, trying to organize things so that they come out the way we prefer. But I feel kind of bad about it, because Americans, for the most part, really don't understand what's involved out there. And it would be safe to say that a lot of people who are out there themselves don't understand what it is that's happening or why, because it quickly gets out of hand. You make plans and plans and plans, and they all go out the window when the action starts.
Okay, that takes me to something really very recent and very specific. The incident in Benghazi when the ambassador was killed, which I'm sure meant was very near to your heart. Your take on how our administration was handling it, because, of course, we know some people think that they were just way out of line.
Yes. It's one of those things which is unfortunate. It became a political issue. And as soon as that happens, an awful lot of rationality goes right out the window. The Republicans saw it as an opportunity to do something which they thought was going to be good for them in the short run and the long run. And the Democrats, of course, who were in power, at least at the government level, had to scramble around trying to cover it up. But drawing on my experience on the Cabinet Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan years, when those things become clear and evident and obvious is after they happen, not before. I remember when I was being briefed with the other members of the task force on an introduction to intelligence, one of the senior people at the CIA, who impressed us all pretty much, I think, said, look, compare it to this. Here's a sign that says Coca-Cola. It has on it, on that sign, there are 2,860 small light bulbs which light up to spell the sign. Your job is to tell us which one of those light bulbs is going to burn out first. Because into your office in the intelligence business come these reams of rumors, reports, estimates, threats. You know, which are the real ones? Afterwards you say, yeah, we should have noticed that. But you can't do it beforehand. There's too much of it, and it's totally out of control. Especially when you have a great big system like we have, which is pulling things in, as we've learned, from all over the world all the time.
Also, on that particular day, there were attempted invasions on the embassy in Egypt, in Cairo, already. So a lot of the misunderstanding was coming from, we had several hot spots occurring simultaneously, wasn't it?
Yes, well, you know, but some of the things are kind of embarrassing, because there was an officer whose name I won't mention who was berating the government for not having deployed his team. His team was ready to go on an hour's notice, and they could have deployed that team right away. It was a communications unit. What are they going to do, hit those guys with their radios? I mean, you know, communications units aren't what's needed in a case like that. Another senior Air Force official said that he could have had airplanes from the air bases in Italy on the ground, or I mean over the area in, I think he said, 3.5 hours. Well, what are you going to do then? So an awful lot of nonsense was spewed out because people saw it to their advantage to do it. Under the circumstances, there was very little that could have been done of any meaning and value to the people who were attacked. How long did it take before it was all over? Not very much. We had nobody on the ground. Should we have had? Well, looking back, it said we should have, I suppose. At the time, it didn't seem like it. Now we know better, but it's too late.
That and Patrick Kennedy testified to the fact that the ambassador was, in fact, traveling with a normal security detail. There was nothing nefarious about him being ordered. In fact, he hadn't been ordered to Benghazi. I don't know how much of the speculation and theories you've heard, Ambassador. So now let's jump forward a little bit to what's happening in Syria. A lot of criticism of the administration regarding the handling of the situation in Syria. Some want us to, well, we should have bombed, and others go, well, no, we don't want another war. So I saw it as he couldn't win either way. But what would your take on how he handled it?
Well, you know, you use the word twice, which I find very interesting. The United States is not in a position to handle that going on. I was invited to Syria, two summers ago last summer, by a group of people who invited a whole flock of experts. I was not one of them. I'm not an expert on Syria, but I was the only American in the group. And we spent our time talking, listening, traveling, going up to Hama and places such as that. And the troubles had already started, but the people who were the real genuine experts, scholars, diplomats, journalists, all agreed unanimously that what was going to happen was that all of the outside forces, both near and far, would join with the inside forces to seek their own goals and objectives, politically, socially, religiously, historically, whatever. The country was going to be overrun with people who wanted to have it come out their way. To our advantage, I think, we were not one of those countries for a lot of very, very good reasons. And I do not think that we could have played a reasonable role there any more than any of the other outside groups. Some of them are from countries in the region. Some of them are from countries very far away. But a cold-eyed, rational examination of the circumstances there would lead me to the conclusion, without hesitation, that it was not for us to solve, it wasn't for us to start, and we cannot step into a situation like that and expect anything good to come of our involvement, unfortunately.
Okay, so when Obama was positioning ships in the Mediterranean and threatening Syria with an attack because of the use of chemical weapons. I guess that's what I was meant when I was referring to handling it. That's an international diplomatic crisis, and I've heard it spun all kinds of ways.
Yeah, and you'll always hear it that way, because you know the what are the true facts of the use of the chemical weapons? I don't know. I doubt if anybody really knows, although an awful lot of people would suggest that they do, because it's so easy to say, if they did it, no, they did it, no, it was done by these other people. We will probably never know, in the same sense that, to infinite regret, we will never be certain about the assassination of President Kennedy all those years ago. Everybody has a story. Everybody has a suggestion. I noticed on the web that somebody's come forward with a second shooter. It becomes emotional more than factual, and trying to pin down what the realities are is almost impossible, and if not impossible, it certainly is extremely difficult. You can't be sure what happened or who did it. And I think we're still in that box today.
Now,
go ahead.
You said earlier that you can't predict the future. However, back in 2003, you did warn that going into Iraq was not a particularly good idea.
Yes.
Somebody looking at your words from then now would say that you did indeed predict the future.
Yes, ma'am. I gave them my best estimate of what would happen if we got rid of Saddam Hussein. I told them what I thought was going to take place. And what's compelling about this, to me at least, is the fact that we had already seen examples of this in places like, well, we call it now Yugoslavia, used to be Yugoslavia. In our country, all across the country, people were waiting desperately for Marshal Tito to pass away so Yugoslavia could flower and prosper. Yeah, well, it didn't quite work out that way. Because once you pulled the cork, which was what you could call Tito, the country came unglued. The same thing happened in Iraq. The same thing will happen in Syria if you pursue it to the logical conclusion, which we think is the right one. Because however awkward it may seem to us, many countries in this world function better in a situation which we would call tightly controlled. It isn't something that we believe in or do ourselves, but it works in far more places than we are comfortable thinking about because the people are used to it and the country is not prepared. Think of it this way. You walk in and say, okay, you guys, right now, you're going to have a democracy. A what? A democracy. What's a democracy? Well, you have to write a constitution first. What? What's a constitution? What are you talking about? Take the situation we have in our own country. When the constitution was written, and it took us 6 years to do it, you know, we then had to sit down and do all the amendments. And in that constitution was a provision for the institution called slavery. And it took us 87 years to get rid of that, and 130 years to give the women a vote. So what do you expect from a country which doesn't even know what you're talking about, and partly isn't sure they really want it for just that reason?
Okay, now, I have a question from Mike in California. I normally only take questions after the break, and we are coming up on a break here shortly. We've got a few minutes yet. But do you think that there's been a collusion between mainstream media and the alternative media and government to clean up America's or the USA's image of the Middle East for the American consumption, Western consumption?
I don't think so. Personally, I wish I could agree with that, but I have a very distinct feeling that a lot of what's happening is going to make it more difficult rather than less difficult for the United States to deal comfortably with many of those countries over there because of the problems that have been generated by the sorts of news that we put out, which paints, Islam as some horrible violation of everything that we stand for and believe in, and it isn't. And paints, the people who profess that religion to be dangerous, if not worse. So I fear that we are going to have a very, very long, hard time. It's important to remember that this happened in connection with the people from different nations when we were at war with those nations. you recall, you know, that we had people change their names from German. The Japanese had a terrible time in this country in the days when we were at war with Japan. We locked them up in prisons, could we call them that? We did some, you know, awful things because of a lack of understanding of what was involved and who was involved. And I'm afraid it's going to be that way with the Middle East for far much longer than it should be, largely because the press doesn't seem to be able to treat it in a rational, reasonable way. It isn't news if you do it like that, you know. No news is good news.
Okay, and that brings me up to the most recent news out of the Middle East, speaking to their attitudes towards the West at this point. Saudi Arabia has rejected a seat in the United Nations Security Council, something, if I understand, has never been done before, and the reasons they stated.
Yeah, the reasons they gave was dissatisfaction with the functioning of the Security Council in terms of dealing with issues that the Saudis consider to be of great importance. You know, this is a perfectly reasonable position, attitude, if you will, because the Saudis think that we should be doing more to solve the problem in Syria. I'm not quite sure how they think we're supposed to do that, but nonetheless, they apparently think that way. They are very dissatisfied with the lack of progress on the part of the Security Council or the United Nations in dealing with the problems that they see in Israel. And so they say, we don't want to be a part of this, you know. We don't want to be associated with an organization which professes to be able to do all these good and wonderful things, but in fact doesn't.
So just very briefly, because again, we're seeing these roilings throughout the Middle East, countries that we had considered stable, like Saudi Arabia. Bahrain is having uprisings. The King of Jordan is under pressure, not to mention the places that are actually hot spots. How long do you expect, just you would pull out your crystal ball you had in 2003 again, before we see some kind of settled, you know, some indication of where this is all going to fall out to? What the end? Because in Egypt, we had one government that lasted for a year, and then the army stepped back in.
Yes, and you know, it's probably, and I hope I'm wrong. It's probably going to be a long time before anything resembling calm and rational internal situations are going to exist in that part of the world. It's just you've unleashed a dragon, if you will. You've turned loose all of the forces that are interested in advancing their own objectives at the cost of other people's. And there's too many groups, and they're too split now, and the blood has been spilled, and people are upset, and memories stay long in action out in that part of the world. I'm afraid it's going to be a really long time before we see something like resembling the return of real stability in several of those countries. Egypt has a better chance than some because it's less bifurcated, if you can use that word, trifurcated, if you want to, than some of the other ones. It's been a country longer. Some of those countries are so new, you know, that the ink hasn't really dried on whatever they have that passes for the rules of government. They've all been released from bondage from the colonial powers in relatively recent times.
Also in Egypt, I was always of the opinion that Egypt, basically, since the end of King Farouk, has essentially been under military rule, directly or indirectly, anyway.
Yeah, it's been a long, long time, which isn't necessarily, you understand, a bad thing. It depends on how it works out. It, you know, our country has been criticized by a lot of people out in the world because they saw us tolerating an awful lot of non-democratic governments because we were seeking stability. We thought that stability was the most important thing. And, let's be honest, nothing good can happen if you don't have stability. Stability is the one thing that you must have in order to make the kind of progress we would like to see them happen. And now what we're being criticized for is seeking stability through fomenting instability. You know, we're going to let these countries go after each other, I should say, let the people in these countries go after each other because we can't figure out what else to do in a way that would be productive for the folks themselves. And so you have to step back and say, we have made a serious mistake in destroying, I think forever, Iraq, destabilizing the area, unleashing the Sunni-Shia rivalries, which had been more or less under control, advancing, you know, the positions of some countries and diminishing the positions of others, sometimes unintentionally, sometimes unfortunately. But it started when we figured that we had the right to go there and tell Iraqis what kind of country they were going to have. It's not our job, not part of our job description, and people do not like it for good reason.
Okay, now, Ambassador, I have some questions waiting for you when we come back from the break. We are going to take a short break here. I want to remind listeners, this is The People Speak, broadcasting live on bbsradio.com. We'll be back with you shortly.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please. Give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
We're tuning into Sundagat University, where we teach the royal kingdom of God, Jesus Christ. Come to Jesus. Recognize you can pray to Jesus. God, Jesus, baby. As you continue to pray to Jesus, you will find the real mystical love and joy of serving Jesus Christ, the divine Son of God. Don't be allergic, baby. Tune in to us at the 8 p.m. Pacific time every other Sunday, and you'll get the joy of Jah Jesus.
Welcome back to The People Speak, live on bbsradio.com, internet radio. Again, I'm Jeanette Lefebvre with my guest, retired Ambassador Edward Peck. During this portion of the show, you can call in questions and comments for our guest, toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, as I indicated during the break, I've already got questions coming in via text for you, and I'm going to get right to them because I don't know how much the time they'll take. Bob in Canada, it seems the media isn't reporting on the mess in Libya, in Iraq, and the other countries that the USA has attacked, occupied, and made into a living hell. Why do you think that is?
Well, the newspapers are business organizations. They would like to hold themselves up to something higher, but the simple fact of the matter is that they have to sell papers or advertising space or advertisers. And if they annoy too many people too many times, people are going to pull their ads, are going to stop advertising, stop buying the paper or listening to the show, and then you're in trouble. So there is a certain amount of self-censorship, which isn't necessarily bad, but does nonetheless tailor the kind of information that people can get from mainstream media. It's a business, and businesses have their own ways of doing things because they have to.
Okay, now this next question from Laura in Maryland. Do you think that the USA and Israel will attack Iran in the near future?
I have no way of knowing. They don't consult with me like they used to. I would hope and pray that they would not. It would be a disaster. There are those who say that Israel might do it on its own just to prevent any kind of rapprochement, which is the word that's being bandied about. Let me point something out to you. Our nation, or at least its representatives, run around the world bellowing and snorting about how the most important thing in the world is to be in touch with people. We push the Israelis and the Palestinians to talk, even though they have some difficulties between them. We push the Greeks and Turks to talk on Cyprus with a bloodstained border between them. We urge the Indians and the Pakistanis to talk across their bloody border. We talk to the Kosovars that they must talk to the
Serbians.
Serbs across their bloody border. But we don't talk to Iran, which is 7,000 miles away. How do you explain that? Well, we have differences. Well, I know you guys, but we haven't killed each other. We've never been at war with them. And we haven't spoken to them in, 40 years? Here's my point. If you have a problem with somebody, a neighbor, business associate, another country, if you have a problem with them, and you sit down to talk about the problem without the intention of giving away anything, but you say, here's what we want, what do you want, and you talk it out back and forth and forth and back, there is a chance. There is a chance that you can either dissolve the problem or remove it entirely, and there's no chance at all if you don't talk, which is why we urge everybody else to talk, but we don't. And that is called dynamic hypocrisy, if you let me quote myself, because that's one of the things that diplomats are used to say, okay, we don't agree on this. Let's see if there's some common ground somewhere nearby where we can work it out. We sat down to talk with the North Vietnamese while we were still bombing their cities and our troops were killing each other on the ground. This is how we stopped the war with Japan. We were at war. And we sat down to talk with them and work it out. That's what you have to do in today's world to minimize or even eliminate problems. You don't do it at a distance with bombers or, excuse the expression, drones.
So then, in your opinion, would President Obama calling President Rouhani the first direct contact between the two leaders of the nations in 40 years have been a step in the right direction?
Oh, my goodness, yes, absolutely. And, well, too delayed for words. You don't have to, you know, move in with each other, but you sit down to say, look, here are our problems. Is there some way to resolve them? And you don't have to give up anything unless you choose to. But you have an opportunity to iron out some of the wrinkles and prevent serious problems by talking. This is one of the problems you see in the Middle East, where the Israelis and the Palestinians don't talk, really, certainly not in terms of anything resembling equality, because one group is the prisoner guards and the other ones are the prisoners. So the Israelis see no reason in the world to talk, because anything that they could talk about is not going to be in their favor, they feel. But Iraq is how many thousand miles from us? 8? 9? We don't have to worry about them. Let's talk. Let's see what we can work out.
Okay, now this next question I have is going to be a bit confrontational, and I'm not sure it really encompasses what you have said, but I'm going to read it to you as it's sent to me. From Dove Z in Washington, Mr. Peck, CIA USA installed Saddam Hussein, Hamid Karzai, and others in the region, the Shah in Iran, also supported and helped by the USA. How do you claim that the USA is not involved with its ally Israel and Saudi in the region? You think it just happened? Did the CIA just stop being involved in the Middle East? How so? The Middle East oil is of major strategic importance to the energy policy of the USA. Your position is contradictory to all known actions and stated positions. Mr. Peck, where does the USA get the majority of its oil? Go ahead.
Well, let's answer the last question first. Not from the Middle East, as your questioner may not know. Most of our oil comes from other parts of the world. But the rest of the world relies heavily on the Middle East, which is important to us, and our companies are working there. But let's start with where you started, sir. With all due respect, you said that we put Saddam Hussein in power and the Shah in power. Well, you've given us an awful lot of power that I don't think we really have in those parts of the world, or really in any part of the world when you come right down to it, unless you want to use armed forces. And I'm not in favor of that. I gather that you're not either. So when we look at the situation now, it's so easy to say, the U.S. started that with its ally Israel. I don't think that anybody in that part of the world really needed involvement by the U.S. in order to have troubles start. They know how to do it. They've done it before. It's been an area of the world where there have been serious difficulties for centuries. For a lot of reasons, long before the United States ever came into existence. It's too easy, much too easy, to just have one country that you can blame for damn near everything that goes wrong and the few things that go right. And I don't think it is reasonable, rational, or more important, correct, to tag the United States with all of those wonderful things that you just talked about, because I personally do not think that you can put us into that key a position in many, many parts of the world. Certainly not out there.
Okay, now, the engineer just beeped in my ear. We have a caller waiting on line one, Asherico. On line one, are you still there? Hello? Doug, do we still have the caller? Okay, caller on line three, if you would introduce yourself and ask your question.
Yeah, hi, this is Rob from California. And Ambassador, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about our government and the power structure that is in the shadows of our government. Is it true that the elitists have the upper hand above our politicians?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think the politicians kind of rule the roost. I am certain as I gather you are, that the elitists have a lot to say about what the politicians decide, but I'm not ready yet to give them control. That's a whole different thing, if you follow me, than being able to influence them. Because from that perspective, of course, anybody can write their congressman, congresswoman, and tell them what they would like. If enough people do it, and do it in the proper way, all of a sudden you'll find that politicians may change their minds. But it isn't necessarily a case of people with only their own personal axe to grind. It also is, in a democracy, or what passes for it, an awful lot of people express their views to their leaders, sometimes in large numbers, which helps, and sometimes rather strongly.
Okay, and one other question. Since you were on the flotilla, what really happened? The people on the flotilla were saying that the Israelis attacked, and the Israelis were saying that they were defending themselves as they were being attacked. What's the truth?
Well, you know, you have to understand first that I was on a very small boat a long distance from where the killing on the Mabee Marmara took place. Our little ship was miles away. But it's always been interesting to me that the Israelis very powerfully claimed that they were attacked. So you're sitting in your living room, and armed men burst in the door, and you defend yourself. Who's attacking who? Here's a ship on the high seas, which was, you know, in international waters, and it was attacked by armed commandos who, as you saw in the movies, you know, rappelling down on the ships armed with guns and all of this. And the Turks on board the ship didn't want that to happen. What were they supposed to do? You know, hold up little signs in protest? No, they attacked with, as you saw, you know, boards and sticks and all of that. But for the Israelis to insist that their commandos were attacked by these unarmed people borders on the ludicrous, if not the hysterical, depending upon which point of view you take. And, you know, nobody ever found any arms. Go ahead. Sorry.
Of course, because the Israelis had no business coming onto the boat with the commandos.
That's right.
If they were in international water, they had no right.
Yeah.
So that's another crime against humanity.
Well, and if it had happened off the coast of Somalia, it would have been called piracy. But, you know, Israel enjoys a special position, which you can either believe it deserves or not, depending upon your point of view. But as far as the U.S. press is concerned, Israel really does no wrong. And just like anything else in life, that's in the eye of the beholder. But certainly in the case of that particular incident or incidents out there in the middle of the, not quite the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, it borders on obscene to suggest that the commandos were attacked when, in fact, they were attacking a ship registered under another flag and which was not engaged in doing anything of harm to Israel at that time.
Thank you. I was well aware of that, but go ahead, sir.
Okay, that's my own view. It's not shared by an awful lot of people, which doesn't make them wrong and me right. You can tell I'm a diplomat. A diplomat, you may know, is an individual who can tell you to go to hell in a manner that makes you look forward to the trip. I've always liked that. It carries a lot of weight.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, the one big bully for a little state, isn't it?
Well, yes, and that's one of the reasons that America can't play the kind of role that the previous questioner poses for us, because they're suspicious of us because they have seen very clearly that we have a client, or to put it the other way, Israel has us as a client and pretty much gets whatever it wants from us, including not making trouble for them when they're engaged in something that they consider to be quite serious.
Okay, and Rock, I'm going to interject here because, Ambassador, I realized here for the first time that you were stationed in the Middle East already while John Glubb was still there. And in fact, John Glubb wrote in his book, A Short History of the Arab People, in his final chapter, a warning of how the media could manipulate reality and the perception of history in a much faster real time and totally change the outcome from what is right and what is just to what is believed and what is accepted.
Well, Glubb was a famous man in his part of the world for a long, long time, honored and revered by pretty much everybody, I guess. And trying to put any group of people into a nutshell, you know, just doesn't work most of the time because personalities are so diverse. You get skeptics, you get realists, you get optimists, you get all sorts of people interacting, looking at the same situation from, you know, opposing points of view, and that makes it awfully hard for anybody, even a Glubb, you know, to work out what is likely to be the situation anywhere, anytime. And certainly the Middle East qualifies as one of those places where you really can't do it with any degree of assurance that you're going to be close to being right, let alone right.
Well, in reference to, when I've discussed this with people over the past year, I point out two things that have happened in the Middle East. One is what we call the law of the universal law of unintended consequences. Your best plans can't always be predicted. And another thing, more regional, it was a Palestinian friend. He goes, it's like before Islam, they let all the genies out of the bottle at once, and they're not going to be able to get them back in.
Yeah, well, but the law of unintended consequences. One of the problems that our nation has, and I speak to you, you know, as a colleague and friend, one of the problems that our nation has is that we suffer from ignorance about the rest of the world. Jeanette, we really don't know much about the rest of the world for a lot of reasons. Partly it's the press, partly it's education, partly it's the size of the country and the distance that separates us from almost everybody except Canada and Mexico. But coupled with that, we have this arrogance that we do know everything about the rest of the world. We have all of these people who run around talking about American exceptionalism. I will quote for you a former Secretary of State, not the last one, who made the following statement: America's role is to remake the world in our image. Now, that goes over so big. Start with Canada, for example. Just what I wanted to be there, and I wasn't, Jeanette. So I was going to put my hand up so she could say, oops, sorry, so that the Secretary of State former could say, you have a question. I have two questions. Question number one, what image are you talking about, Mississippi or New Hampshire? Bayonne, New Jersey, or San Francisco, California? Second question, if we're going to make Afghanistan like America, wouldn't there be some utility in discovering what skills are needed and developing those skills by making New Hampshire like Mississippi or vice versa? Call me. What are you talking about, you idiot? They may want some of the things that we have, but I can't think of a single country in the world that wants to be exactly like us any more than we want to be exactly like any other country in the world. That's just nonsense, and it's frightening nonsense, because we are convinced that if we just give them a chance, they'll be just like us, but they'll have to pick which part of us they're going to be just like, and that ain't going to be easy.
Okay, I've got a few more questions coming in, and we're coming short on time. From John in the Canadian Rockies: Mr. Ambassador, in your opinion, what is the most significant thing I, as a person, can do to build a peaceful world for my grandchildren and their grandchildren?
Oh my goodness, sir! What a question. That's galactic in its importance and significance. You live in a country which has done a lot of the sorts of things that you're talking about, both internally and externally. I'm very proud of having had an opportunity to visit, talk in, and travel around in Canada. But just being informed, being involved, are the two things that matter the most in a democracy such as yours, or the one that's here, and helping to guide and steer the people who direct your government into doing the sorts of things that you think are important. I don't think enough of us do that in this country. I'm not quite so sure about it up in Canada, where you've had a much better record in terms of dealing with your internal issues than we have. But keep up doing what you're doing. That's the best thing. Small contributions, you know, pile up if a lot of people get involved. And good luck to you.
Okay, now from Ken in Florida, is there a New World Order plan to invade Africa next?
Oh, goodness gracious, what a question. It's hard to imagine any world order coming up in the near future, but invading Africa, good Lord, where would you go? What would you do? How would you do it? There's a part of the world that we don't pay enough attention to. It makes the Middle East look like Denmark, you know, by contrast. The things that happen and don't happen, the death rate. But part of the difficulty here is that, look, I'll give you an example. Forgive me for this, Jeanette. I lecture on cruise ships. It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it. And I gave a lecture on the world, and I pointed out with PowerPoint that 33% of the people in the world drink unclean water, contaminated water. So afterwards, I was talking to some people gathered around the podium, and this one gentleman kind of pushed his way to the front, and he said, you said 33% of the people don't drink good water. And I said, yes, I'm afraid that's true. And he said, well, why the hell don't they just move? Okay, now how do you answer that question? World order? No, I don't think so. I can't imagine who would be involved in it. NATO? United Nations? United States? It's unlikely, and it will probably be impossible, I'm afraid.
Okay, one final question for the evening from Sylvia in Georgia. When will the USA stop committing terrorism in the Middle East, Ambassador?
Well, if it's up to me, it'll stop now. But remember, this is painful, and I think we're doing wrong things there to a large degree, extraordinarily wrong. But terrorism is in the eye of the beholder. Your terrorist is my freedom fighter, and vice versa. If you look back at what they would have called George Washington if they had the term, he was a terrorist trying to overthrow the government. So many people who founded their nations as leaders, you know, started out having to kill people to get a chance to do it. So what we're doing now flies in the face of everything I think the nation stands for, and I regret it profoundly, because you generate far more enemies than you do friends. You generate far more difficulties than you solve them by indiscriminately killing people in so many countries of the world now. That does not help them. It certainly does not help us.
Yeah, one of the things that I've expressed when I discuss this issue is, while here in the United States are so concerned about the deficit and the debt we're leaving, the financial debt we're leaving our children and grandchildren, but I tend to be a bit more concerned about that debt of hatred and hostility towards U.S. that our children and grandchildren will be facing 10 or 20 years down the road based on what we're doing now.
You're quite right. You're quite right. Yeah. Well, it's a tragedy. All you can do is hope, you know, that with the passage of time, some of these memories will fade. Look at relations between the U.S. and Japan, between the U.S. and Germany, the U.S. and Vietnam, following bloody wars. But part of the problem is that, you know, we're far apart, and we don't have... But if you travel to those countries, the warmth and the friendliness and all of that, and the impact of those countries' economies and their automobiles and their food in this country is astonishing when you look at where we were. So, yeah. It's a tragedy. We have an awful lot of people who will have memories that are bad. If you go to Pearl Harbor, to the wreck of the USS Arizona, most of the visitors there, or a lot of the visitors there, are Japanese people on tour. And the whole thing is presented as two countries, you know, making serious mistakes. And when you go to Hiroshima in Japan, where the atomic bomb fell, it's the same approach. And you go to Hamburg in Germany, and you go to the big Gothic cathedral, which is just in ruins. They have a museum there, and it says right in there, in English and in German, we brought this on ourselves. So countries, people, can come to grips with reality.
It just takes time.
With the passage of time. Okay, dear.
Okay, well, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us tonight, Ambassador Peck, and being so patient with our questions. This is Jeanette Lefebvre saying goodnight from the People Speak Radio on bbsradio.com. Join us next Tuesday with David Rovics, musician with a social conscience. Good night, and thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.